a subject like this, which, as you've seen from the Standard, is the rise and coming fall of the SWP, that's the Socialist Workers' Party, for those who don't know what the initials stand for, it would have been preferable from our point of view to have had a debate with a representative of the SWP, but we didn't bother this time because we know from recent experience that they refused to debate us, although there was a time when they would and did, and I think they're still mopping up their bloody noses, so probably, you know, the word has gone round now that it's not much point debating the SPGB because apart from exposing our weaknesses, we don't get any converts that way. In fact, we lose them. And as a result of a couple of debates with the SWP in years gone by, we have gained members from that organisation. So you can see why they're reluctant to debate us. So this time, we didn't bother to try to get somebody along because we knew it would be a waste of time. But Adam's going to speak on the subject for about 30 to 35 minutes, a bit longer than usual. Usually manage to say what we have to say in 20 minutes. But there's a lot to say on the shortcomings and contradictions of such organisations as the SWP, and it's important to give Adam Buick some time to expand on the subject. So without taking any much more of his time or yours, I'll ask him to start. I'll just mention that after he spoke, as is the usual practice, there will be time for questions and discussion, any other things you want to raise. We have to be out by 10, so hopefully we can bring the actual talking to a close at about 10 to 10, 5 to 10, give us time to get some literature or whatever. So I'll call upon Adam to open up on his subject now.
Okay, thank you, Comrade Chair. Now, if the SWP's own claims are to be believed, the SWP is now the fourth largest party in England. That's England as opposed to Great Britain. It's ahead of, it's, you've got first of all the Tories and the Labour and the Liberals, and then the fourth party will be the SWP. I mean, this is a position that used to be taken by the old Communist Party, was then taken by the old SDP, both of which disappeared, and nobody regrets that, and was later taken by the Green Party. Now, the SWP is currently claiming that it has 8,500 members and rising, which would mean that it is in the process of overtaking the Green Party, which reached a peak of 20,000 members in 1990 and is falling, probably falling below that level. Now, I'm not sure that I believe the SWP's membership claims. What I want to do this evening is to describe the origin and the growth of the SWP from a tiny Trotskyist sect in 1949-1950 to its emergence as the SWP, the Socialist Workers' Party, in 1976-1977. Well, you know, for the record, the SWP was officially launched as the infant vanguard party of the working class on the 1st of January 1977. Then I want to go on to explain why, in my opinion, the SWP is riding for a fall. Basically, the reason for this, I would say, is because of its Leninist nature. Not just that it is a Leninist organisation trying to operate in a post-Leninist era, and therefore objectively irrelevant, but because of its undemocratic Leninist internal structure, which will eventually put off many of the people who are now joining in the intense recruitment drive that's been going on since last year. Now, the first point to know about the SWP is that it is a Leninist Trotskyist organisation. It differs, or I think you'd probably say now, it differed since the point is no longer relevant. It differed from the other Trotskyist groups in that it had a different view as to what Russia was under Stalin down to Gorbachev. According to, well, when I first became interested in political ideas in the early 1960s, I went along to the meeting of the local branch of the youth section of the Labour Party. This was in Abbot Leary in South Wales. Now, this branch was controlled by a Trotskyist group. In fact, branches of the Youth Secular Party tend to be even now, and the group in question happened to be the one associated with the paper at the time called Keep Left, which was controlled by Gerry Healy. Now, at one of their meetings, one of the there was a report on a conference of the YS, and one of the delegates was reporting back, and he kept referring to a group of people he called the state caps. He said they'd done this, they voted that way, and so on and so forth. Now, I assumed that the state caps were a group of people who stood for state capitalism, even though I found it hard to believe, in fact, that any group would openly admit to this. Eventually, I discovered that the state caps were a tendency within the Trotskyist movement, which held that Russia was state capitalist, as opposed to the degenerate worker state that Trotsky himself had said it was. Now, the originator of this, you can call it heresy, if you like, within the Trotskyist movement was a Trotskyist called Tony Cliff. And this is the second thing to understand about the SWP. It is Tony Cliff's party. He founded it, and he is its virtual leader. Now, on paper, the SWP has a collective leadership. There's no doubt whatsoever that Cliff is the dominant figure in this leadership. Now, Roger Protz, who was, as it happened, the editor of this paper, Keep Left, at one time, then he moved over and became the editor of Socialist Worker, and then he became the editor or the organiser of the Campaign for Real Ale. I suggest he probably did more for the working class in that organisation than he did in either of the two Trotskyist organisations. Anyway, this is what he has said after he was expelled from the SWP, that's predecessor to call the International Socialist, in 1975. He says this: "It was always Cliff who advanced these southern ideas. Cliff would drag a new theory out of his left ear one morning, and it became holy writ the next day. If Cliff wanted to change the line would change. He was IS to start with, and people paid him enormous respect, which was due to him. But he would be very friendly to you one week, and the next week he'd be cutting you dead because you weren't agreeing with some new line he devised." And this man, of course, is speaking from personal experience, but this is to anticipate a little. It was in 1949, while still a member of the Trotskyist Revolutionary Communist Party. Now, this is not the same as the organisation that's called the RCP today, an organisation which existed in Britain between 1944 and 1949, which is the one time in the history of Trotskyists in Britain when most of them were all in the same organisation. So, I say, it was in 1949, while he was a member of this organisation, that Cliff first advanced the theory that Russia was state capitalist. Now, some of his admirers claim that he was the first to develop and propagate the idea that Russia was state capitalist. This, of course, is absurd. I mean, I hope I won't be regarded as making some sort of a sectarian point if I say that we in the Socialist Party were saying that Russia was state capitalist since 1918, 1919, and we propagated this view almost alone in the 1920s and the 1930s. In fact, in 1948, and this is before Cliff's theory of state capitalism appeared as an obscure internal document in an obscure political party, the Revolutionary Communist Party, since then, quite its whole existence was smaller than the SPGB. In 1948, we published this pamphlet, Russia Since 1917, which in fact is a reprint of articles which we'd said about the Bolsheviks and about Russia, you know, a reprint of articles from 1917 until 1947. So we advanced the theory there that Russia was state capitalist. There was, however, of course, a fundamental difference between the theory of state capitalism which we put forward and Cliff's. I mean, basically, our view was that Russia was state capitalist because of the wages system exists, and the very existence of the wages system showed that society in Russia, as in the rest of the world, was divided into two basic classes: those who monopolised the means of production, and the working class, who were excluded from such ownership and control and were therefore forced to work for a wage or a salary. Now, a consequence of this theory is that Russia was state capitalist under Lenin and under Trotsky, as well as under Stalin. And this, of course, Cliff vehemently denies. According to him, Russia suddenly became state capitalist in 1928. that was the year of Stalin's final victory over Trotsky in the power struggle that developed between the two of them to succeed Lenin as dictator of Russia. Before that, according to Cliff, what Russia was a worker state, a deformed one, but as far as he was concerned, a worker state nevertheless. Now, we in the Socialist Party, we don't think that the term worker state makes any sense. In fact, we think it's a contradiction in terms, so it's not a term we use ourselves. But I must make this point. The SWP says that its immediate aim is to establish a worker state in Britain. And they also say that Russia was a worker state between 1917 and 1928. And this despite the fact that in Russia during that period there was a one-party dictatorship, the government was opposed to strikes, and the government tried to integrate the trade unions into the state machine. Now, clearly this means that they don't see any contradiction between these anti-working class features and the sort of regime they would like to see established in Britain. So I would suggest that my first reaction to hearing these people called the state caps and thinking that they stood for state capitalism was the right one. I mean, we as the Socialist Party, we stand for socialism, if you like, as it was originally understood and what it logically means, a system of society based on the common ownership and the democratic control of the means of production, where wealth is produced purely and simply to satisfy people's needs. You don't have any wages system, you don't have a state, you don't have any workers, you don't have any classes. Anyway, to return to the rise of the SWP, Cliff wasn't excluded from the orthodox Trotskyist movement simply for holding that Russia was state capitalist. As a matter of fact, Trotsky's widow held his view and she wasn't expelled. This was brought about by a practical application of this theory to the Korean War, which broke out in 1950. Now, by then, the RCP had dissolved itself, and its members, including Cliff, had entered the Labour Party. I mean, not many people know that Cliff was a card-carrying member of the Labour Party for nearly 20 years. Anyway, Cliff and his handful of supporters within the Trotskyist movement argued against taking sides in this war. And of course, this was a logical position, because if you hold that Korea and China are state capitalist, and if they get involved in a war with two other capitalist states, South Korea and America, there's no reason to take sides. Whereas the orthodox Trotskyist position, which held that North Korea and China were some sort of, I don't know, degenerate worker states or deformed worker states, they were committed to supporting the North Korean-Chinese side, which they did, and they expelled Cliff for betraying proletarian internationalism or something of that sort. As a matter of fact, this was the only occasion on which Cliff has taken up a principal position on the question of war, since, of course, on this issue, he was right. Socialists don't take sides in wars between capitalist states. And he was never to take this position again. For instance, in the 1960s, during the Vietnam War, he supported the North Vietnamese side, even though he openly said that Ho Chi Minh was presiding over a state capitalist regime in the North, and his aim was to extend this regime to the South. I mean, after taking this position, it was downhill all the way. When Khomeini got in conflict with America, the SWP supported Iran. When Iraq got in conflict with America, the SWP supported Iraq. Now, I know you're all wondering, what was the position that the SWP took up when Iran and Iraq came into conflict? Well, I believe the answer is that they supported Iran, but don't ask me why. You'll have to ask some dialectician amongst the leadership of the SWP. Anyway, in 1950, Cliff was on his own. He'd been expelled from the Orthodox Trotskyist movement, but he was a member of the Labour Party. Now, he did what any would-be Trotskyist leader of the working class would have done in the same circumstances. He drew up a list of transitional demands, and he founded a paper to try to win support on this basis. This paper was called Socialist Review. Now, I've got here this paper's immediate programme from the 1950s, and I'll read just some of the others. There's 12 articles, I won't read them all. So, this is what it says. Read Socialist Review, the Labour Journal, Socialist Review stands for. The complete nationalisation of heavy industry, the banks, insurance and the land. The renationalisation without compensation of all denationalised industries, suspend interest on the national debt, compensation to ex-owners only as a result of an income test administered by elected workers' committees. A majority of workers' representatives on all nationalised and area boards subject to frequent election, immediate recall and receiving the average wage obtaining in the industry. Abolition of payments for National Health Service and the private beds. Sliding scale of adequate pensions based on new realistic cost of living indices. Interest-free housing loans to local authorities and drastic powers to requisition and rent-free state-owned land. And a foreign policy based on independence of both Washington and Moscow. Withdrawal of British troops overseas. Freedom of colonial peoples and offer of economic and technical aid. Now, as you can see, this is conventional left-wing stuff. And this is what Clift's group, which was renamed the International Socialists in 1960, remained for the whole of the 1950s and for most of the 1960s. During this period, you can say that the Clift group was a Trotskyist, entryist group within the Labour Party, similar to things like today, I don't know, socialist organiser, Labour briefing and so on. I mean, I say similar to groups like that rather than to militant, because the Clifts group was never as successful as militant was, only as unsuccessful as these other groups were. As far as I know, they were only able to capture one constituency Labour Party, and that was in Esher, in Surrey, hardly a proletarian stronghold. They did succeed also in getting two members adopted as official Labour Party candidates. Once again, in leafy Surrey, there was John Palmer in Croydon North West, and in 1964, and Mike Dowling in Woking in 1966. I've got here John Palmer's election manifesto. Let's go with Labour and get things done. As I say, Palmer was a leading member of the International Socialists till 1975. He was a journalist on the ground. I think he still does. But by this time, the 1960s, thanks to recruiting Labour supporters or within the CND movement, the IS managed to cross the three-figure barrier. In other words, they increased from 99 to 100. In other words, this time we're talking of a very small group within the Labour Party, much smaller than we were at the time, much smaller than we are now. Now, 1968 was the turning point in the fortunes of the IS. The experience of the 1964 and 1966 Labour governments, which they, of course, had worked so hard to get elected, such as you had the opposition to strikes, you had a wage freeze, you had welfare cuts, and National Health Service charges and so on. This led to many workers coming to see the Labour Party for what it was and to withdraw their support of it. The IS decided that they should follow the lead of the workers, and in 1967 they took a decision to withdraw from working within the Labour Party. This was formalised in June 1968 when they changed the name of their paper from Labour Worker to Socialist Worker. I mean, that, say, another thing which not many people know is that, in fact, Socialist Worker's original name was Labour Worker. But of course, other things were happening in this time, 1967, 1968. There was a student revolt all over the world. They had the students revolting in Berkeley in California, in Germany, in Britain in the LSE, where the current number two in the SWP hierarchy, Chris Harman, first came to prominence as a leader of the occupation of the LSE. And then all this culminated in the events in France in May and June 1968, when a student revolt sparked off a general strike by workers, which nearly toppled De Gaulle. At the same time, the Viet Cong were making headway against the American army, and they were cheered on by their supporters in the West, and people still talk about the demonstration in Grosvenor Square outside the American embassy of that year. In August, the Soviet tanks had crushed the Dubček experiment in Czechoslovakia, so demonstrating for all to see that Russia was just as much an imperialist country as was America. But, you know, so as the Queen might say, 1968 was an annus mirabilis as far as the left were concerned. And during this period, the membership of IS increased from about 300 at the beginning of 1968 to nearly 1,000 at the end of the year. Quite honest about this, overtaking the SBGB for the first time. I don't think somebody at the back said sour grapes or something. These were the people who joined were mainly radicalised students and ex-students. Now, the IS leadership, that is to say, Clift, decided that the time had come to transform the group into a more serious revolutionary organisation, by which they meant to become a more centralised and disciplined organisation. So Brownish autonomy was abolished and more power was vested in the executive committee. At the same time, there was a turn to the class, as it was called, and a desperate attempt was made to recruit manual and industrial workers. The IS members were sent to sell socialist worker outside the factory at 6 o'clock in the morning. Some of them were actually sent to work in factories and on the buses and to go and live on council estates. I mean, the result, in fact, was an increase in members, but once again, mainly of students and ex-students rather than industrial workers. Now, the breakthrough they were expecting towards industrial workers didn't come until the early 70s, after the election of the Heath Tory government in 1970. Needless to say, at this 1970 election, despite being outside the Labour Party, and in spite of the anti-working class record of the Wilson government, which had run the affairs of British capitalism since 1964, IS called for the return and the re-election of Wilson. Now, under the Tory government, as some people in this room will remember, a number of industrial disputes broke out. In 1972, there was the first national miners' strike since 1926. There was the occupation on Clyde side of Upper Clyde shipyards and various other occupations over the country. In 1973, there was action against the Industrial Relations Act and jailing of five dockers for opposing it. And in 1974, there was the second miners' strike, which resulted in Heath sort of saying, all right, I've enough of it. I'm going to the country on an election. Who rules the country, us or the unions? And, of course, he got the thumbs down. Wilson became Prime Minister, once again with IS support. And during this period of Tory rule, IS membership really surged, reaching the 4,000 figure level. And during the 1972 miners' strike, the sales of socialist worker reached 40,000, which is a figure they've never reached since. They made the link with the industrial militants that others sought to. I mean, a number joined IS, and IS printed, if not entirely controlled, a whole range of rank-and-file newspapers. There was the Car Worker, the Collier, the platform for bus workers, textile worker, dock worker, building worker, and so on. But also, amongst white-collar workers, there was a Redder Tape for civil servants, Nalgo Action News, and the most successful of all of them, rank-and-file teacher, which had a circulation of 10,000. Now, by March 1974, IS felt strong enough to launch a national rank-and-file movement. I mean, its founding conference was attended by 500 delegates from 270 sponsoring organisations, which is trade union branches, shop steward committees, rank-and-file journals and so on. I mean, this was a major success for IS. At last, they seemed to have achieved their dream of replacing the Communist Party as a party for industrial militants, but it wasn't to last. Within a year or so, IS had lost nearly everything it had built up in the previous 2 to 3 years as the industrial militants deserted it. Now, I want to suggest that there were two main reasons for this. The first was that the period 1973-1974, it was the biggest recession in Britain since the war. I know we've heard that two or three times, twice, but that was exactly the case. The first one was in 1973-1974, and we now know this was the beginning of a return to periods of 10-year cycles, each one worse than the other. So unemployment went up, and where this happens, the trade union bargaining position is weakened, and industrial militancy falls. I mean, IS, of course, was quite aware of this, and they laid quite a bit of emphasis on it in the subsequent post-mortem that they held on what had happened. But the second factor they ignored completely, and that was their own misjudgment of what industrial militancy represents. I mean, Cliff had always dreamed of creating a Leninist vanguard party on the basis of the shop stewards movement. In fact, he had a vision of transforming the shop stewards movement into such a party. As I say, 1973, 1974, this period, everything seemed to be going his way. Links had been made with the industrial militants, and an economic crisis, which he expected would radicalise workers, had broken out. Now, Cliff drew the conclusion that to benefit from this and to prepare to lead the working class in the coming crisis, IS should become even more Leninist, that is to say, yet more centralised and yet more disciplined. For instance, the International Socialist issued a pamphlet at the time called The Struggle for Workers' Power, by Roger Rosewell. He's not a very credible person because I think he soon left IS and became the Social Democratic Party or something like that. But at the time, this is an official pamphlet. It says, "The International Socialist is a Leninist organization. Our traditions are those of workers' revolution and Marxist theory, typified above all by the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Because we are a Leninist organization, our history is obviously connected to Trotsky's heroic struggle against Stalin." It says, "The International Socialists consistently defended Leninist principles against all who sought to revise them, and as such are now the largest revolutionary organization in Britain." And they went on, "No such mass revolutionary party exists in Britain today. Until it does, the crisis of leadership will remain." This is classic Trotskyist Leninist stuff about what's wrong is that the workers haven't got the right leaders. Now, what IS tried to do in the 1974-1975 was to put this into practice and use the National Rank and File movement for its own party-building political ends. And this had disastrous results. I mean, not only was this industrial militancy, as I suggested, a consequence of passing industrial factors, but the industrial militants were not prepared to take orders from the SWP's executive committee. I mean, when this was tried, as for instance, they ordered their members in the AEU, what it was called at that time, to put up their own candidates, even against left-wing candidates. The militants refused to do this. And, well, they voted with their feet and left IS. The same thing happened with the whole of the IS building section, and many of the factory branches which they built over this period collapsed. Now, the IS leadership, in true Leninist fashion, imagine what they were doing was manipulating the industrial militants and trying to channel their discontent at work into a particular political direction. But a case can be made out for seeing things as being the other way around, that it was the industrial militants who were using IS for their technical expertise and for their printing press. I mean, many members of IS were, in fact still are, university lecturers and journalists with access to information that could be helpful to rank and file groups. I mean, the information on productivity deals, factory legislation, social security legislation, and so on. And of course, as I said, IS had a printing press. So in this analysis, IS was being used by the unofficial militants as a sort of unofficial research department. You know, and why not? The only victims were the IS leaders themselves, and it served them right for being so presumptuous to imagine that they were the leaders of the working class. Now, the only conclusion that the IS leaders drew from this disaster was, to say, once again, to become yet more Leninist. In 1975, the Executive Committee, which already had considerable power, was renamed the Central Committee, and it's composed exclusively of full-time paid officials of the SWP. So basically what was happening was that the countdown had begun towards converting IS from an organisation into a party. Now, such a change would be of great significance within the Trotskyist movement because it was a declaration that IS was no longer a tendency, no longer a current, no longer a group, which might at some future stage get together with other groups to form the Leninist vanguard party that was to lead the workers of Britain. It amounted to a declaration that IS was this party, even if only in infant form, to use Paul Foot's term. It amounted, if you like, to a declaration of hostility and opposition to all other Leninist groups. And this is precisely what IS, well, say this is precisely how it was interpreted by IS when Cliff announced decided in 1976 that his organisation should convert itself into the SWP, the Socialist Workers' Party. This was formally launched, as I said, 1st of January 1977. But already before that, as a means of publicising what was going on, they contested a number of parliamentary by-elections. And this continued into 1977, into 1978. And then, of course, in the 1979 general election, they were again saying, vote Labour. Now, their most disastrous election result must have been the one at Birmingham Stretchford in 1977, where Paul Foot finished bottom of the poll with 377 votes. But in the having the indignity of being beaten by a candidate from another Trotskyist group, the IMG, who got 494 votes. But the really significant thing was that the National Front was third ahead of the Liberals with 2,955 votes. Now, from 1966 onwards, the Cliff group as the SWP has become, had one aim and one aim only, and that was to build a party by recruiting as many members as possible. And this has involved setting up satellite organisations like the Anti-Nazi League, and then creaming off some of the militants and activists into the SWP, or jumping on a bandwagon which some other group or somebody else has set rolling and trying to do the same thing, for instance, as with the anti-poll tax campaign. At the moment, the SWP is and has been since last year involved in an intense recruitment drive. This is actually called the Turn to Recruitment, and the official name is the Open Door Recruitment, which means what it says. Anybody who vaguely agrees with the SWP's aims is invited, indeed pestered, to join. I've got here an IS internal document. Well, IS, SWP, well, in fact, SWM, because it was found by one of our Irish comrades who visited one of their meetings. He found it on one of the chairs afterwards. It's called Making the Turn to Recruitment. And it says, we must adapt to take the steps necessary to thoroughly implement open-door recruitment. Every non-member at a meeting must be asked to join the SWM. This not only involves a call from the platform, but it means that every member must have on their membership cards and registration forms and must ask individually any non-member at the meeting to join. The nature of the period has proved that numbers of new individuals will respond if they ask directly, do you want to join the SWM? Today's regular readers of the paper are tomorrow's recruits. This is particularly so in the outlook period, where we can expect a further radicalisation and great battles ahead. Therefore, every member must take at least 3 papers every month. One is their own copy, and they sell the others to their friends. It's such a bad idea. People who make it plain that they won't join just now, and even more distant contacts, must be allocated to a member to drop off the paper every month. Somebody must keep tabs to see that this is done. Sometimes someone is asked to join but refuses for the time being. Ask them if they will take papers for their friends. This is a good way of pulling people into a more organised relationship with us. It concludes, the biggest danger we face is that we do not go after recruitment vigorously enough and miss opportunities to significantly increase the size of the SWM. These steps, together with a determined political will from the branch leadership, will help properly implement the open door perspective. Now, a couple of months ago, I went to a meeting in Acton Town Hall, which was addressed by Tony Cliff, and his argument was that there were stormy times ahead, and in stormy times, you need to have a bigger boat rather than a smaller one. So he said, what we've got to do is try and make the SWP bigger. And he went on to say that if you believe in control from below, and if you are not a racialist, then your place is in the SWP. Now, I couldn't get out of this meeting without running the gauntlet of SWP members waving membership application forms. I mean, I took them. I didn't fill it in, but I'm quite convinced that all of us in this room could join the SWP next week. If we all go along to their meeting in Hammersmith on Wednesday or Thursday, we can all join and double the membership of their branch. Because, I mean, as they say, it's as easy as that. It's an open door policy. You just knock at the door and they let you in. Now, this is why I'm prepared to stick my neck out, if you like, and predict the coming fall of the SWP. I mean, fantastic claims are being made by the SWP about the success of its current open-door recruitment policy. I mean, here is Lindsay German, editor of Socialist Review, writing in the March issue. We have grown by 2,500 members since the Pitts crisis in October. We have doubled our size to 8,500 since the poll tax riots under 3 years ago. Sales of socialist worker have risen by 80% in the past year. Now, even if this was half true, which would mean that they'd recruited 1,250 members in the last 6 months, this would be quite an achievement. The trouble is, it wouldn't represent a real shift in working class opinion. It wouldn't represent a real radicalisation of the working class. Because, I mean, if this had been the case, it would be reflected in the membership of all organisations calling themselves socialism, and this hasn't been noticed by other organisations. I mean, we've noticed a modest increase in interest in socialist ideas, but I mean, if people are talking about huge increases of 60% and thousands joining, then it's something different. But the evidence just isn't there. All it represents is the conversion of some of the regular readers of Socialist Worker into SWP members. Now, such a change in the formal status of readers of Socialist Worker might comfort the leaders of the SWP that it's becoming bigger, that they're both being bigger and they'll survive stormy times, but it contains a number of dangers for them. I mean, first, it means a decline in the quality of their membership, both in terms of understanding and commitment. I hasten to add, not an objective decline in quality, but a decline in quality as far as the SWP's own point of view. I mean, already there are rumours that they've relaxed the rule which they inherited from the old Bolshevik principle that attendance at branch meetings is a requirement of membership. Because, I mean, as the SWP isn't a democratic organisation, this is not going to present much of a problem. What it must mean is that there must become more of a gap between the leadership of the organisation and the membership. You know, with a lower quality membership or membership having less understanding of what the SWP really stands for, the role of the leaders as defenders of the SWP orthodoxy will become more important. Now, it is this that leads to the second reason why I think it's reasonable to talk of the coming fall of the SWP. Now, many of these new recruits won't be Leninists. In fact, without, even if they don't actually realise it, a lot of them will be anti-Leninists. Because, as I said, at this meeting, Cliff said, if you believe in control from below, if you think that miners should decide whether pitch should stay open or nurses should decide whether hospital wards should stay open, your place is in the SWP. Now, if you believe, believing in control from below, which is believing in democratic control, this is an anti-Leninist proposition. It's certainly not the way the SWP itself is organised. So if people are being recruited into the SWP on the basis of believing in democratic control, so-called control from below, they're in for a rude shock. Because the SWP is a leadership organisation, not just in the sense of an organisation that wants to lead the working class, but in the sense that it is organised on a hierarchical leadership basis. The SWP branches are controlled by the branch leadership, which meets in secret from ordinary branch members. Then there's a district or regional leadership under the responsibility of a full-time party official. At the top is the central committee, which is a self-perpetuating body composed exclusively, as I said before, of full-time party officials. Now, I say self-perpetuating because of the way in which it's elected. It's elected by, at the conference, the outgoing central committee proposes a list of names to the conference, you know, for them to endorse. And you can see quickly what this means. It means that the SWP central committee can only be renewed by cooptation. You know, they choose who their successors are going to be and they throw out people who've been awkward. So all the conference has to do is to rubber stamp the approved list. And the Central Committee also has power to make policy in between conferences. This is called giving a lead, and it's something that is both expected and accepted by the membership. Now, it should be clear, anybody joining such an organisation who believes in control from below is sooner or later going to be disillusioned. Now, previous experience, which is partly based on, talking to members of the Socialist Party who were formerly in IS or the SWP, suggests that it takes about 18 months for this to happen, for the disillusioned members to leave the SWP. So if my analysis is right, the crisis in the SWP will break out sometime next year. Many of the new recruits will begin to leave, and because they've exhausted the reserves of recruitment amongst readers of Socialist Worker, the membership will begin to fall. You'll have splits and you'll have recriminations, just as happened in the period 1974, 1975, and 1976. Chairman's been passing me notes to sit down, so I'll sit down at this point, even though it's not a very good ending.